The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
I think the Buddha was really interested in helping us to understand what's going on in our minds that creates and makes us struggle with the world, with ourselves, with our relationships, with our cultures, with our work, with whatever we're doing. And he was pointing to that while there are things that happen in the world, you know, there's things that happen in the world that we don't like, that may even be unethical or dangerous that other people do, we do not have to give over our ease of mind and ability to stay balanced and clear in our hearts to what other people do. We may tend to think that, you know, things along, well, that person did that, that made me angry or frustrated or hurt or whatever it was. But the whole, what the Buddha was pointing to is, yes, there are things that happen out there. And then those interact with our conditions, our conditioning, and that conditioning and that how that lands internally generates something. It generates a response or a reaction. And responses might be very different in different situations. Sometimes responses might be of generosity and kindness and patience. At other times, anger and frustration and hatred. But it is the response that we have is not something that somebody else can do to us. And that's good news. It feels like it's something somebody else is doing to us sometimes, but that's partly just because the conditioning, the way that we've been conditioned, those responses and reactions tend to happen quickly, and without a certain level of mindfulness, we don't really see where they're coming from. And so it feels like that person did that, and that made me angry, or that made me frustrated. And so the Buddha was asking us and telling us that with mindfulness, we can really start to see these processes that go on in here. And the very seeing of them, the very seeing of those processes begins to shift the way that our system functions. Because as we start to see that those processes, those reactions, the things that we believe about the world are conditioned and not necessary, maybe useful at times. Certain beliefs, certain views are useful at times. But as we understand them as beliefs and views, as we understand what's happening here as what's happening here and not necessarily being created from outside, then that very seeing helps the mind to recognize, oh, this, some of the suffering, the struggle that's happening here, the vast majority of it, of what I call suffering, is actually something that the mind is doing to itself. And as it sees that, as the mind begins to recognize that it's doing something that is making itself suffer, it begins to change its relationship to that. It begins to look for other ways. And so very naturally, it begins to adjust the way it relates to the world. And so this practice of mindfulness helps us to see these processes at work. He often used this phrase in teaching. I actually looked at, I have the Pali Canon on my, those teachings of the Buddha on my Kindle, and I pulled it up today, and I looked for that phrase in one of the books, just one of them. I can't remember how many times, but it was hundreds. It was hundreds of times that phrase appears. And the phrase is, as it actually is. we should, it's said over and over again, see, recognize what's seen, heard, smelled, tasted, touched, cognized, as it actually is. And what he's pointing to here is basically that we tend to not see things as they actually are. We see them through our views, our ideas, our reactions, and we are not simply knowing what's actually going on in the world. We, as Anais Nin famously said, we don't see the world as we are, as it is. We don't see the world as it actually is. We see the world as we are. We see the world through our views, through our reactivity, through our emotions, and that flavors. That flavors how we take things in. It flavors our perceptions. It makes us respond, or it has us kind of believing certain things are true when they may or may not be. And so this seeing things as they are, you know, it's not something that we typically have access to. And so what I'd like to explore tonight is some of the things that get in the way of seeing things as they are. And I'm going to phrase this or frame this as things that our minds add to experience that prevent us from seeing things as they are. Those things in our mind that have us seeing things as we are. So things that we add to experience. And this adding happens in a very natural way, in a very conditioned way. It's not like it's our fault that we're adding things. It's that, you know, we've been conditioned. I talked about conditioning the last time I was here. You know, we have been conditioned to engage in the world in certain ways. We have learned from our parents how to respond to things. We have learned from our friends and in school how to relate to various situations. We've learned from our societies and cultures what to believe. And so this is conditioned. I mean, it's like what is put in, that becomes the way that we engage. It's just a very natural functioning of our human system, essentially. The Buddha phrased this natural functioning something along the lines of, whatever one frequently ponders becomes the inclination of the mind. And so, as we're children, essentially, we are frequently pondering what our parents tell us. We are frequently pondering how our school friends engage with us. We are frequently pondering the ways in which we feel like we get what we want. For some people, that might be being very aggressive. For other people, it might be kind of being manipulative. For other people, it might be being very sweet. There's just different ways we've each learned to engage in the world. In general, to make things to be more pleasant and to have things be less unpleasant. And so this is just a kind of very human part of our experience. That we, when things are pleasant, we tend to like them, want them, want to get more of them. When things are unpleasant, we tend to want to get rid of them. And whatever strategies that we've learned through our education and our upbringing, those are the strategies that get reinforced. And so those are the ones that tend to follow us through our lives and pop up. So it's not like it's our fault that this happens. It's a whole web of conditioning that creates how we are in this moment in relationship to our experience. And yet, as the Buddha points out, you know, essentially what tends to go on is like, so whatever we frequently ponder, however we've been conditioned, that becomes the inclination of the mind, tends to be what follows. And if we are not mindful of what's happening and not aware that certain conditioned habits and patterns are actually creating a feeling of distress, of dissatisfaction, of pain, of confusion, if we're not aware that our habits and patterns are actually doing that creating, we think that it's something out there that's making those feelings happen. And so we continue to try our same strategies, reinforcing those same strategies. But when we start to play with mindfulness, we start to see these strategies are coming up from inside. We see that they're coming up in relationship to our history and conditioning. And so that exploration of starting to look at what is happening in this mind that's actually contributing or in relationship to what's happening in the world, what's happening inside in relationship to what's in the world that might be contributing to this being's distress. If we can get curious about that, then we can start to have a whole different process unfold. So the very same process that gets us hooked into our habits and patterns from the time we're children, with mindfulness, that same pattern kind of begins to recognize when that action happens, that choice inside is leading to distress. And so the mind begins to understand and learn that may not be so helpful, begins to let it go. So I'd like to talk tonight about some of the ways. I doubt that I'll get to even all of the ways I have listed in this in these notes that we add things to our experience that are those filters through which we see life so that we're not seeing things as they are, but seeing things as we are. And I'm pretty sure that even in these notes, it's not exhaustive. So, but I just want to give you some flavors of some of the ways these things happen. And the first one that I'll point to is something that's added. I just mentioned it briefly, is that when there's something pleasant that's happening or something that's unpleasant that's happening, we tend to like what's pleasant, not like what's unpleasant, and that leads us into a kind of a wanting to have more of what's pleasant and a wanting to get rid of what's unpleasant, and then further can lead into full-on greed or anger or fear or hatred, so a kind of a tumbling of reactivity, of reactive emotions. Those reactive emotions are, when we stop and actually look at them, when we pay attention to them with some degree of mindfulness, we recognize that those reactive emotions themselves are distressful. They don't feel good. They're painful. And yet our mind, in not seeing them, has believed that they are helping us to navigate the situation so that we will get what we want. And so essentially, those habits are so deeply conditioned that we are not actually recognizing their painful nature in the moment. And so, again, the mindfulness really helpful. So to start to see how this process works helps us to see that that kind of suffering nature of those very reactive states. It's kind of a surprise, at least for me, when I really first felt in it to that anger and started to see some of the beliefs that were behind it. You know, the belief that this anger was going to make the other person miserable. I was missing entirely that I was miserable in the anger itself because my mind was so hooked to, yeah, that person's going to be so miserable because I'm so mad at them. I was missing that I was pretty miserable. And when I started to see that, the mind was like, wow, look at this. This is what the mind is doing to itself, this anger. This anger is optional. It's extra. It's added. And so the first part of this is that there's, you know, this is kind of continual stream of things that are pleasant and unpleasant and neutral in our experience. That's just going to happen. That's life. That doesn't change. That, you know, essentially we... being human beings, having these bodies, we will experience pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And then we start to move into a relationship to that because there are beliefs, we could say, that And this is, again, kind of deep underlying this whole process. It's not as simple as just, oh, something's pleasant, then of course I go towards that. I mean, that feels like an of course. But underlying that, of course, I move to what's pleasant. I want things to be pleasant. I want to get rid of things that are unpleasant. Underlying that movement is actually a belief that I need to have what's pleasant in order to be okay. And I need to get rid of what's unpleasant in order to be okay. And that's kind of more at the level of belief there. That, and I'll talk more about views and beliefs in a moment, because that's another whole realm of what we add. It's kind of the deeper layer of what goes on underneath these reactivities. Whenever there's some kind of reactivity going on, there's some kind of belief underneath it that is often not seen because it's just taken to be the way things are. You know, we think we're seeing the way things are, believing that thing, believing that I need to have things that are pleasant. I need to get rid of things that are unpleasant. Having that thing is what is going to make me happy, another belief. We just think that's true. We think that's seeing things as they are. But that's really a set of beliefs that have been conditioned into us, partly through our human organism and partly through our cultures and families and how we have learned to engage. So we can start to see this pleasantness, this unpleasantness, and initially we might think that that movement towards desire, towards even the liking and the not liking. You know, liking and not liking are pretty subtle. The movement of liking and not liking around pleasant and unpleasant often very quickly shifts to something more than that. If it's simply liking and not liking, it can be interesting to notice that too, because the liking and the not liking are actually added as well. They're not as, they're not as distressful as full-out hatred and arrogance and pride and all of these more reactive emotions. But, you know, they are actually a little bit of an adding. That something's pleasant, we like it. Something's unpleasant, we don't like it. That's almost a little more deeply human that we move in that direction. But the liking and not liking, one thing that's useful to notice is maybe it doesn't feel like we're doing any adding there. It's just kind of very naturally coming. But it's really helpful to recognize that the pleasantness and the liking are not the same thing. And the unpleasantness and the not liking are not the same thing. The pleasantness is sensation. Physical sensation, mental sensation. And the liking or not liking is what we could call the first or the second. So the pleasantness, the unpleasantness is kind of the first contact, and then the liking or not liking is the second thing something that our minds are doing with that liking or with that pleasant or unpleasant. It's not a problem to be liking and not liking, but when that's not noticed, when it's not noticed that the pleasant and the liking are different, that the not unpleasant and the not liking are different, very often it moves into a more ramped up response. Something's pleasant, we have to have it. It becomes more of a neediness, of a greed, of a craving, because if I don't get that thing, then I'm not going to be okay. That's more of the reactivity. That's more where there's a little bit of extra churning in the mind that is adding to our experience. And that adding of that neediness, that craving. Now again, the experience of that, when we notice it in the present moment as we start to explore with mindfulness what we're adding to experience, as we start to explore that experience of craving itself, the feeling of, oh, I'm not going to be okay unless I get that thing, the leaning towards, the reaching out. As we start to explore that experience itself, we notice its painful nature. We notice it hurts. It is distress. It's distressful to want something and not have it. And our minds have the underlying belief that the only way for that distress to fall away is to get the thing that we want. So that's a part of this whole belief structure underlying this process. So something's pleasant, we're craving it because we think we need it in order to be happy. The craving itself feels unpleasant. We don't like that feeling. And we think in order for that feeling, you know, the mind, the craving itself, the mind that's hooked by that craving, caught in the beliefs of the craving. You know, when we're really caught in the craving, we are picking up the whole belief structure of craving, which tells us if you don't get that thing, you are not going to be okay. And so that, you know, when we're kind of hooked into that whole belief structure, we are not really seeing the painfulness of the craving itself, but only seeing the possible relief that we'll get when we get that thing. And so the that craving, that belief structure of craving, is not going to tell you, is not going to kind of give you the information that if that craving were to go away, that there would not be a problem. That craving is so caught in its belief that it has to get the thing, it can't see that its own, that the mind can't see that that craving is the suffering. That craving is the dissatisfaction. As soon as craving springs up, there's a feeling of lack. And the belief of craving is that I have to do something to fill that lack. But the craving itself is what created that lack, that experience of lack. And so the whole structure, we can start to see this, and actually hearing a description of this, kind of the way this process works, can help us to recognize this process at work in our own minds. And so we can begin by being curious about our reactions when they happen. You know, the strategy here isn't to have an antagonistic attitude about the things that we add to experience, because they are conditioned. We have frequently pondered these patterns, so of course they're coming up. The medicine that the Buddha offers us is awareness combined with wisdom. This little bit of wisdom that I'm offering here about how this works can help us to have some curiosity about these reactive patterns and witness them with mindfulness. Begin to learn that craving already is suffering, that aversion already is suffering. I don't have to get rid of the thing in order to be okay. Seeing this, It can be something we can play with at times if there's a kind of something that springs up, a kind of a wanting that springs up about something that you know intellectually you do not need. Now, you know, the wanting is telling you you have to have it. And it can be very compelling, but we know intellectually that, yeah, we don't need that thing. And so sometimes we can find ourselves in a situation where we notice that this wanting has sprung up about something that we know we don't really need. And so rather than repressing the feeling of wanting, kind of the sense of I'm not going to pay it, not going to follow through on that, just stuff it, instead be curious about the experience of wanting. What does that feel like? What does it feel like to want that thing? The feeling of the pull towards it. The mind things that come up, the images that come up about the having of it and the happiness that's going to be there in the having of it. So a simple example. One day I was driving someplace and I got stopped at a red light, and across the street, just catty corner to the red light, was a Starbucks. And that Starbucks created in my mind the image of a latte, which was a pleasant experience, and wanting came up. The light was red for long enough that I noticed the wanting and just, okay, well, I'm not going to, I decided I'm not going to follow through on that wanting. I am going to watch the wanting and just see what happens. And sitting there at the light, I could see the mind's like creation of the image of standing in the Starbucks and having the latte and putting the chocolate on top and, you know, all of that stuff, and then drinking it. The happiness, the mind creating an idea of happiness. When that was going on, it was less in touch with the feeling of the wanting itself. That kind of feeling of dissatisfaction, the pull, the toppling over. So just seeing that, watching that. The light turned green. I made a left turn. And as I turned left, it would have been really easy to like just make a quick right into the Starbucks. And the wanting got stronger as I got to the place where it would be easier to follow through on that. But I held to my commitment. I did not follow through. And as soon as I was past the Starbucks, the wanting went away. And seeing that kind of experience where you actually see the wanting disappear, that gives your mind a learning, kind of gives the mind a learning, a deep learning that the thing isn't what creates the happiness. Essentially, you know, there is a little bit of happiness that does come when we get something pleasant that we like, that we want. You know, that when we get something pleasant, that when we're associated with something pleasant, there is a happiness, a pleasantness that comes with that association with the pleasant. But the vast majority of the happiness that comes from getting what we want is because the wanting goes away. And the experience of the wanting going away, there's a kind of a release in that. That at times it can feel like, you know, being, if you're really clear, really seeing it very clearly, as I have seen on some retreats, this kind of the mind just hooked into this wanting and then watching the wanting go away, it feels like being released from prison or being released from a vice grip. It's like the mind has just been so contracted and in this world where it could see nothing else. And then the wanting goes away and it's like, whew, the world opens up again. So this process of seeing, being curious about the wanting, being curious about what's added. This goes for whatever is added. It includes all our reactive emotions. Can we be curious about them? Get familiar with how they affect us. What goes on in there? What are the beliefs that happen? What are the thoughts that happen? Seeing if there can be a kind of, when there can be a curiosity about our reactive emotions, it gives us a lot of room to let those patterns kind of play out without repression and without expression. It's kind of this fine line that we can walk with mindfulness, that as something comes up, some kind of reactive emotion comes up, if we're curious about it and interested in it, just as a phenomenon, just as, oh, this is what human beings feel like when they're angry or frustrated or confused or impatient or wanting something, craving. This is what human beings feel. That gives us more space to watch these processes at work. Gives us more space to learn about our minds. And that learning about our minds is what the wisdom that comes as we learn about our minds is what helps the mind to kind of change direction away from its habitually conditioned habits into a direction that leads towards less suffering, less constriction, less reactivity. So one thing I do like to point to as we, you know, look at reactivity, and one of the beliefs deeply embedded in reactivity is that the reactivity, so if we're angry about something or if that we want something, that the beliefs in there is like, I would not do anything about this situation if it were not for this anger or this wanting. And so when we're caught in the belief of the wanting and the greed and the aversion, when we're caught in the belief structure of those states of mind have us believe that they are the sole motivating source of action in our lives. They cannot fathom another way to act in the world. And so when we're caught in greed, for example, we can't fathom that the wholesome quality of generosity and kindness could also motivate action. When we're caught by aversion of, you know, reacting to something unethical or something harmful that somebody else is doing, we can't fathom that anger, anything other than anger, would help us to correct that situation. But as we start to have these things fall away, as these extra addings fall away, we see that there's kind of some motivations that are very natural, that come from a more wholesome place. Compassion, for example, will motivate us to act in the face of suffering, will motivate us to act in the face of injustice. And so we can begin to recognize that the beliefs embedded in these states of greed and aversion are not necessarily true. So the next piece that I want to explore, and then maybe this will be the last piece, and there's others I have, but to speak a little bit more about views and beliefs, because this is a huge area of what we add, and it is often invisible. When we are reactive, that's less invisible because we're feeling something there. Often we're thinking it's coming from the outside, but we are feeling the feelings of reactivity. And so that can be a little bit of a wake-up bell in terms of helping us to pay attention. But views and beliefs are often so deeply conditioned that we do not, we don't even know that they're beliefs. We just take them to be the way it is. So there's many ways that views and beliefs kind of come into being, happen for us. And there's different kinds. Let's say there's different kinds of views and beliefs. So there's what we could call our own personal views and beliefs that are based on our own personal conditioning, the own way that we've been shaped by our experience because of our own body and the way our minds work. So there's kind of our own personal things. And so no two people going through the world are going to see things in exactly the same way because we're all shaped slightly differently. And so these are more personal kinds of things that maybe, you know, we can see in conversation with people, oh, not everybody thinks that way? That's interesting. So those are the more personal things. Those can be a little bit easier to start to see as we grow up and we have conversations with friends and people that we don't know. We begin to realize, wow, there's different ways to look at the world. Then there's another level of conditioning that we could call more societal level or cultural level conditioning. This is a kind of level of conditioning that we share with a larger group of people. And these can be even harder to see because so many of us share the same views and beliefs that we're not getting that kind of opportunity to recognize, oh, people have different views about this topic. Every time we talk to somebody in our kind of clan or in our tribe, whatever, we talk to somebody in our tribe, it's like, yeah, I agree. Yep, that's the way it is. Yep, that's true. That's right. And so it's kind of reinforced that that's the way it is. And then maybe we expand our horizons a little bit and meet somebody in a different kind of group or clan and see that, wow, there's a different structure there. But because there's so many people that we've shared this belief system with, it's a little bit harder to kind of hold it lightly. It's more like, no, this is what I've been taught for my whole life. This is the way people are supposed to be together. And the way they are, that's just weird. And it's wrong. So, you know, different religions have different perspectives. Different cultures have different perspectives. And this is where a lot of our clashing in our culture comes from, this level of view. These kind of societal, cultural views and perspectives. This is right, this is wrong. And the whole, you know, religious wars kind of thing comes because of different cultural conditioning, different views about what is true, what is right. And so these beliefs run a little more deeply in our psyche. And then there's another level of view that we could call human views. And this one I may not get to too much tonight, but I'll just mention it here. This is kind of views that we share as human beings, in a way. Perceptions of the way the world is. And this, in brief, we could say that as human beings, we tend to believe that there are things that are permanent and reliable, and that there is an I or me in here. There's a sense of self. This sense of self is a truth, an entity, that I exist as a being. And so these are ways in which we, and just kind of in living in this body, the sense apparatus that we have tends to, let's say, mask the impermanent, really radically impermanent nature of the world, tends to mask that because things are radically impermanent, there is nothing that's reliable as a place to land and say, oh, I'll find happiness there. Because wherever we land with something that's like, yep, I'll find happiness there, it's changing even as we land there. And so this view or belief that there's something to land on, something that will make me happy, is a kind of a deeply human view. But it is not what I would say, it's not a hardwired view. It is something that, and this is essentially some of the deepest level of seeing what's added, these levels of basically taking what's impermanent to be permanent, taking what's unreliable to be reliable. This is a deep layer of adding that we all do as human beings. And it takes somebody like the Buddha to come along and point out to us, hey, you know, this is not actually a strategy that works for finding true happiness, to believe that there's something reliable out there. So the Buddha found in his own experience these truths, that the unreliable, impermanent, unreliable, not-self nature of experience is the way things actually are. It's kind of that's the truth he was pointing to, in the see things as they actually are. Impermanent, unreliable, not self. And with that, he discovered in his own experience, not taking their things to be permanent, reliable self, suffering goes away. Very deeply suffering goes away. So just to come back to the more familiar ways that we have views, you know, the deeper layers of those, you know, the kind of views that we have, the human views that we have. In my experience, it's like we kind of have to work our way down through the layers of reactivity, through the layers of conditioning, our human our personal conditioning, our cultural conditioning, and start to kind of unpack and see all of these ways that our mind works as extra, as added. And then we can actually, you know, as the mind kind of settles into understanding these whole processes at work, then we can start to see these deeper human kinds of processes as also things that are added. The sense of self is something that's added. The belief there's something reliable as something that's added. So views, you know, we hold all kinds of views about who we are, what we're capable of, and often not seeing that they're views. Essentially, when we take something about, well, this is who I am, this is what I tend to do, and we do this about others too. It's not only that we do this about ourselves, we do it about others. Well, that's what that person is, that's what they always do. You know, we feel this when other people do this to us, when they say, well, this is what you do. It's like, well, wait a minute, no, I'm not always like that. You know, that's not who I am. But we do this to ourselves too. And so, you know, the ways in which we have these views about ourselves, it kind of limits us. It boxes us in. We box ourselves in. We box other people in. And they're really hard to see. And so, you know, sometimes we can start to see, maybe we can start to see, a little bit of a way we can start to see this is when there's a kind of a sense of me and them. Like self and other. You know, that's who they are. This is who I am. There's something limiting there. There's some kind of view or belief there. What are you taking there? What are you believing there? So this is a key, actually, in terms of exploring views. And what I'd say is, I mentioned earlier that any time there is a form of reactivity, anytime there is a form of struggle or suffering or distress, there's the distress itself, the feeling of the anger or the confusion or the hatred or the rage or the impatience or the frustration. There's the feeling that is useful to recognize and know, to bring our mindfulness to. But knowing and understanding that that feeling is motivated by a belief that's underneath. It can be useful when there is a little bit of balance in the mind, when the mind can be curious about that, when it's caught by that anger, this is not the time to try to ask this question, not the time to try to do this kind of exploration. But when there is a little bit of a sense more of, oh, this is what it's like to be a human being that's feeling anger, then the question, and what is being believed, can be really useful. What is the belief that's like deep under that anger? And it's not about trying to figure out what the belief is, but it's more like just having the question, dropping the question in to the mindfulness of this whole pattern that's happening, dropping the question of, and what's being believed right now, may allow there to be a kind of the way my teacher Sayadaw Utejaniya points to these kinds of questions, and he's really the one I learned this tool of using questions from. And he says, you know, when you ask the mind a question, when you do that, he said, just because the mind is naturally curious, and you know, we are naturally curious when we're born. Sometimes that curiosity gets pounded out of us, but there is a natural kind of curiosity. And when we are mindful, we are closer to that naturalness. And so when we drop in a question like that, that kind of place of the natural curiosity can start to like, it's like the mind starts to be curious about that question, and it's not something we're having to figure out. So just like dropping this question into a pond, if you have a pond that's pretty smooth, you drop a pebble into the pond, and there'll be ripples from that pebble. And likewise, when you drop a question like that into the mind of what are the beliefs happening here, sometimes those ripples are clear very quickly. And you don't have to go looking. But sometimes they're not so clear. And if they're not so clear, then just let it go. You do not have to try to figure out what the belief is. But just keep being curious. You know, what is being believed? Because there is some belief underneath those emotions, underneath those reactivities. There's some kind of belief happening there. Let's see. I have more I can say, but let's see if there's comments or questions. I thought I'd take a little more time here for that. Kaylin, and then, yeah.
You talk a lot about like human habits and maybe beliefs that we're kind of born with or wherever they come from. Is there ever a sense of where maybe some of that is useful and maybe some of it's not, and there's this tangled mess and kind of how to deal with that in a sense? Or is it just not useful at all and let's kind of start fresh and use this Buddhist way kind of thing? I don't know if that makes
sense. There are patterns that are natural that are helpful. I mean, this very same patterns of conditioning, the very same things that get us hooked into reactivity, those same patterns also at times in our lives, or, you know, some people seem to be, you know, come into the world with a little more equanimity or something, you know, that we sometimes stumble into very wholesome things that help us, that move us in the direction more towards a deeper kind of happiness, not the happiness that comes from getting things, but the happiness that comes from a kind of you know, letting go of neediness, a letting go of craving. So there are definitely patterns that we have that are helpful. And so what we begin, I think the mindfulness helps us to tease apart those, that big jumble of patterns. That you know, as we start to look at the reactive patterns, we see the reactivity itself is suffering. We see that the beliefs in there have there's a kind of a constricted view around that that's limiting. And so we see that the reactive patterns are not actually leading towards anything helpful. But there are also times like, you know, I think actually within any suffering, this is something that I've been exploring, teaching in the last couple of years, that I really do feel like in any suffering, so those reactivities are a kind of, they are extra, but they are also kind of coming out of, let's say, a desire, a deep wish to be happy and safe and healthy and at ease in our lives. You know, so there's that thread in our human organism that wants to be well. That is a wholesome wish. That's the wish of metta, of compassion. And yet what happens with that wish often is that it bumps up against what we can call the truth, or things as they actually are, with this thing that I started with, that things are impermanent and unreliable and uncontrollable. And so when these two kinds of threads get bump up against each other, it's like we get a tangled knot. Because, and partly that tangled knot is some of the strategies that our families and cultures have told us, well, here's how you deal with this kind of situation. You know, if you want to be safe and things feel unreliable, you need to get angry or you need to get frustrated. So, you know, we're taught that basically. But so you know, but there are these truths, or this is the way things are. Things are impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable. And there's this deep movement towards well-being. And both of those are, you know, the truths are just the truths. And the deep wishes, those are human. And they are wholesome. But the ways that we've learned when those things bump up against each other creates this knot, creates a tangle. And so that is where we really have what's added, is in that tangle. And so our relationship to that tangle is often something like, that's a problem, I have a knot. I have a knot in my cloth. And yet we don't understand, or our minds can't quite see that there can be a kind of a belief in our minds around these deep wishes of metta. You know, when we bump up against the truth of unreliability, the wish for safety and the truth of unreliability, you know, they don't feel like they coexist very well. And I've seen in my own mind this kind of belief like, well, if, you know, things really are unreliable and they do seem to be unreliable, then I should not want to be safe. It's almost like repressing the wish, something like that. And or else there's the sense of, well, if the wish is valid, then this is just wrong. And so there's not a sense of how can these two coexist. And so there's the tangle right there. And so, you know, we we think, you know, we got a knot in our cloth. It's like, well, the knot is bad. We feel like the knot is somehow problematic. And might take the scissors. It's like, you know, I definitely felt this about my self-hatred. It's like, yep, that is like cancer. It needs to be, I need to get the scalpel. I need to get the whole thing out and just get rid of it. But what I began to understand is that that whole mess of self-hatred is composed of these threads of wanting to be safe and happy and healthy. And yeah, things are not controllable. And they're impermanent and unreliable. And so, you know, it's not that the threads are the problem. It's the knot. The self-hatred is an issue. And our minds can't quite see, well, is there a way to untangle this? And that's actually a poem the Buddha offered. Who can untangle the tangle? What can untangle the tangle is mindfulness and wisdom. And it's kind of like the mindfulness and wisdom are like a lubricant that lets us just be with this, whatever, the suffering that's happening, this pattern of reactivity. And the being with it is kind of like a lubricant that lets it untangle. And then we start to, with a little bit more trust and curiosity, see that those two threads that are coming together like this can be more of a weave than a knot. And that's where the mind can begin to more deeply understand that, yeah, these two can coexist. They weave together. It creates a cloth that these weave together. And there's not a hole in that cloth. And our mind just begins to understand things from a completely different perspective. And so what I'd say is whenever there's any kind of suffering, there's an opportunity in that suffering to see the pointing to this wish for metta, the deep, beautiful wish for compassion and metta that's natural in us and as human beings and is beautiful in us as human beings, and is also a pointer to these truths, this things as they actually are. And so wherever there's suffering, there's this opportunity to have this knot turn into this weave, not from getting rid of or kind of cutting out, but it's more just letting the threads untangle so that we can see there's a different configuration that's possible. Now it's time to stop. So, thank you.